Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Streams of Winter, Livestream 18, House Dame.
Hello and welcome to the Streams of Winter. I'm Yoke Boy and we are Radio Westeros. Thanks so much to all of you for tuning into this live stream this afternoon. We'll be talking today about a whole house, a Dornish house, which is full of mystery and intrigue and to some extent has a sort of cult status in the fandom, I think. Guys, we're talking, of course, about House Dane of Starfall. They are a noble house who loom large in the plot, and we think their role is perhaps set to expand in the Winds of Winter. So what will become of Darkstar, Edric, or Illyria? Who will wield the illustrious and famous Blade Dawn? And just what is it about this house that seems to set them apart from the crowd? There is some weird mystique, isn't there? To help me answer these questions and more, here's the other half of Radio Westeros, Lady Gwyn.
Hello, everybody. Thank you. Thanks for being here. We are so really excited about this House Dane content because there's so much to talk about. People, things, places, you name it, we've got it with House Dane. So we're going to start out with focus on one of the most controversial members of House Dane, that being Sir Gerald Darkstar Dane. So that should be fun for the first half or so of today's broadcast. But let me introduce today's guest who's here to help talk Darkstar and all things Dane with us. We're happy to welcome Monaro from Monaro Geek TV. Hi there, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. I just want to say hello to everyone and thank Radio Westeros, Lady Gwyn and Yoke Boy for inviting me, especially to talk about House Dane and one of my favorite bad boys, Darkstar.
Yay! Well, we're glad you could be here for this. It was a long time coming. We started talking about this a long time, like months and months and months ago. So glad it's finally here. Reminder to everyone that it spoilers everything, so we will be talking about some Winds content potentially. So that said, back over to you, Yoke Boy. Let's go.
Yeah, spoilers all books. I know you love that line, guys. And for the Winds of Winter sample chapters, obviously. So let's get on with it, and we'll talk about Darkstar, the bad boy, one of Monaro's favorites. Arya Hotar and Abara Sand are on their way to High Hermitage with Balon Swan, ostensibly bringing justice to Sir Gerald Dane for his attack on Mycella. Previously, we talked a lot about Hotar, Obara, and Sir Balon, but today we're here to talk about Darkstar. So let me begin with asking, who exactly is Gerald Dane, and why did he get involved in Arianne's Queenmaker plot? And to begin, why don't you take us away, Monaro?
Well, Gerald Dane is a cousin of Arthur Dane, according to the story, and his seat is in High Hermitage in the mountains of Dornir Starfall. I think he got involved with the Arianne's Queenmaker plot to gain an advantage for himself and House Dane. As it stands, Arthur is dead, and the next in line is Edric Dane as the Lord of Starfall. So he's obviously jealous of his cousin Arthur, and he may want the title of Lord of Starfall for himself because the only two males that are left in the line are himself and Edric. He could also want to make a bigger name for himself because he's known as Darkstar, but everybody knows that the the envy title for House Dane is the Sword of the Morning. So Myrcella being made queen and him playing a part in her being made queen would be a great way for him to be made Lord of Starfall.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we see it time and again, people sort of throwing in with whatever candidate they think is going to give them what they want, you know, throughout the War of the Five Kings. You know, if you have competing candidates for lordships or what have you, you know, they just pick whichever candidate for the throne they think will give them that reward. So great point. And I'm also glad that you brought up the relationship between Darkstar and the main branch of House Dane, because the A Feast for Crows appendix lists Gerald Dane as Edric's cousin and bannerman, and Gerald himself calls Arthur his cousin. It's never mentioned specifically what the relationship is, but I feel like it's much closer than what Cadet Branch often implies. We see cadet branches of House Arryn and House Stark and House Lannister that are all pretty far removed from the main family. But in the case of Darkstar, I feel like this palpable jealousy he has of his cousin Arthur probably indicates a relationship that's so close that Gerald Dane might, like you mentioned, have some sort of claim to Starfall. You know, he might be right behind Illyria as Edric's heir. So while many feel like Arianne might have had some kind of influence over him, I think it's pretty clearly telegraphed in the first Arianne sample chapter that she actually didn't know him all that well. So I'm more of the mind that his involvement was something meant to serve his own interests rather than something that he did for Arianne. Plus, that also seems to be more like in keeping with his character, what little we know of it so far.
You both make great points, and I think you're in agreement about a lot of them. And I was going to say, for me, it's a really interesting question about Darkstar's motives in entering this plot. If, as reported, he did in fact slash the face of Princess Myrcella, then that is a hell of a commitment to this cause, isn't it? As Minari explained, there's a possibility that he was trying to climb the ladder in some way and make a bigger name for himself. But why would he want war? We know that from his conversations with Arianne, he knew exactly what that attack meant. This is how you start a war, he says, not with a crown of gold, but with a blade of steel. It's a cowardly act, and obviously not carried out by a man with any honour. But I can't really understand his full motives behind it. This tells me that there's going to be a lot more to Darkstar than meets the eye. And I'm beyond curious to see how George adds further shading to this character and what twists and revelations might be in store. Some people talk about Darkstar like he's a character that we all know really well inside out. But until we understand just what he wants and why he wants it, I don't think we know him very much at all. Until then, he remains somewhat two-dimensional for me, which is why I think portions of the fandom don't really connect with this character as George had intended, as this sort of perhaps romantic badass character. So, moving on, in the Princess and the Tower chapter, Doran says to Arianne, "You are a fool to make him part of this. Darkstar is the most dangerous man in Dorne. You and he have done us all great harm." So why exactly does Doran judge Darkstar to be the most dangerous man in Dorne? What's the reasons, you think, Lady Gwyn?
Well, I think that statement is another very good reason to assume that the Danes of High Hermitage are actually quite close to the Danes of Starfall, because you don't get a lot of knightly houses, which is what High Hermitage is, that are attributed with great power. Yet in A Feast for Crows, when she's considering her Queenmaker plot, Arianne thinks that if the Ironwoods were to side with the Iron Throne against her and Myrcella, she will, quote, have Darkstar destroy them root and branch. Now, House Ironwood is second only to House Martell and Dorne as far as power and influence. So that's expecting a lot of firepower, a lot of influence from what might seem at first glance to be a relatively minor knightly house. Later in Arianne 1, in Winds of Winter, Daemon Sand mentions that Darkstar is more viper than Oberyn ever was and says that it's a pity Oberyn never got around to killing him. And I think that all in all, if the Martells are going to tread with caution around this man, that we as the readers should really take note.
What do you think, Monaro?
I agree with what Lady Gwyn just said. And I actually didn't even give it much thought about how much power the house itself in and of itself actually holds with in regard to the Martells. I thought that Darkstar's thoughts and feelings were not so far removed from the Sand Snakes in that they wanted to start a war as a way of avenging their father. Though his ambition and I think his jealousy of his cousin, which is kind of weird that you're jealous of a cousin that already died, but I guess because of his cousin's reputation, and that you can't mention the Dane house without mentioning Sir Arthur Dane. So I think, you know, he kind of lives in the shadow of that. And so that also makes him quite dangerous. We're also left to kind of speculate of his cruel deeds because we hear about how cruel and dangerous he is from others, but we've never actually seen those deeds played out on the page. But we do get a glimpse of it when he attempts to murder Myrcella. That act in and of itself brought dishonor to House Martell and to Dorne, and it puts them in a dangerous position with the might of the Iron Throne and the Reach. As we know, Dorne and the Reach have a lot of bad blood between them. The Reach is tied to the Iron Throne by marriage because of Margaery. So this would mean they would be involved in any war that were to break out between the Iron Throne in retaliation for Myrcella. So as Dorne states, they don't have the strength to fight the Iron Throne because they don't really have a huge army because they're not really a very populated part of the Westeros. But history has shown that the terrain of Dorne has always given them an advantage in any fight, which the Sand Snakes make mention of. So they could use the terrain to their advantage in any war or any skirmish that were to break out between themselves and the Iron Throne.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I want to add one other thing, which is just getting back to the simple statement about him being dangerous. I've always had this sort of thought that there might be something meta about that statement, which is kind of unrelated to the actual plot. But in Westeros, and especially in Dorne, knowledge is power and probably in some cases also danger. So I'm very interested in the fact that High Hermitage lies directly on the route from the Prince's Pass to Starfall, meaning that any group looking to travel directly from, say, the Tower of Joy to Starfall would almost certainly go right past High Hermitage. Darkstar would have been a young squire about Bran's age in 283. And considering how much we see Bran get up to in a Game of Thrones early on, you know, he gained some pretty secret knowledge in a very short period of time at the beginning of the books. So I have to wonder if there might not be some little parallel there, you know, 7-year-old boy kind of messing around and finds out something he shouldn't or sees something he shouldn't see. So I've always wondered if that dangerous knowledge might be George kind of nudging us to think maybe Geraldine has some sort of, you know, knowledge that might be dangerous to some people or some information about something, you know, that he witnessed all those years ago that will come out later in the story.
Nice. That's quite imaginative thinking there, Lady Gwyn.
Well,
I like it. So just to round up the question, I think Doran calling Darkstar the most dangerous man in Dorne really serves a meta literary purpose. George must have been up against it, trying to sort of craft this character within the Dornish plot, where so much had to be established in such a small amount of page space in A Feast for Crows. When I think of all the information in those chapters, they're just loaded. So I think Doran was trying to sell this character to us. If he's feared by characters in-universe, especially by Darkstar's Dornish liege, who speaks with wisdom and some authority, then this blunt statement says much about this rogue character in just a few words. So there's a sort of a meta reason why he might have used that line, just, you know, communicate so much so quickly. And in our live stream a few weeks back, we wondered about the news from Ariane's sample chapters that Abara, Aereo and Balon had been sent on this hunt that we've talked about to find Darkstar. Our patron, Mae Jernigan, wonders whose POV we'll be experiencing the Danes from, in all likelihood, in the Winds of Winter. And this is it. I think it's here. It's with Aereo Hotar. So what are the odds of Abara in particular carrying out Doran's orders, considering she and Sir Gerald seem to be ideologically aligned, perhaps? What happens when these two come face to face, Minaro?
When those two come face to face, I think they might have a very interesting conversation. Because as I stated earlier, they are kind of somewhat aligned in wanting to go to war with the Iron Throne, but their reason for doing so are very different. And remember that Ariane wanted to use him because he's good with a sword. So obviously he's a good fighter and he would be a good person to have in the ranks. So Abara is still looking to avenge her father, and Darkstar is in favor of going to war with the Iron Throne, keeping in mind that Aereo and Sir Balon Swan are with Abara. So Hotar being loyal to Doran and wanting to follow through with his orders to capture Darkstar, and Swan being a Kingsguard loyal to the crown, there may be a showdown between them. But I think Darkstar, to me, seems to be more of a self-preserving type, especially from what happened when they got caught during the Queenmaker's plot. His first instinct was, I'm going to chop this little girl's head off and run out, because he was not about to fight, you know, get into a fight that he couldn't win. And so I would see that play out here, unless he thinks that he can get an advantage by talking to Abara and kind of convincing her, hey, don't take me in. Then the only people that he would really have to contend with, truly, if he can convince her of that, would be Aereo Hotar and Sir Balon Swan. And I don't see that happening. So the other part of me is thinking that he's going to probably try to be more on the self-preservation, take the more self-preservation route, and kind of like, I'm going to go ahead and dip out and kind of rethink my strategy so that I can live to fight another day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that he and Abara are definitely aligned in terms of their goals and kind of their worldview. That's some of the trouble between Aereo Hotar and Abara that we talked about a couple weeks back, I think is going to come up, because, you know, she probably is far more likely to ally herself with Darkstar, who's a man of Dorne, who shares her overall kind of, you know, outlook on things and what the Dornish should be doing for their own benefit, than she is to ally herself with Balon Swan, who this marcher lord from the Stormlands, who's, you know, their kind of ancient enemy, and she's already expressed a desire to outright murder him on account of his complicity in the plot to kill Trystane. And so whatever happens, we know that Aereo Hotar is almost certain to serve and obey his master, Prince Doran. So in my opinion, Darkstar's fate is going to come down to whatever Doran's actual orders were to Ariohota, which I'm not convinced that we know those orders yet. But you raise a very good point that Darkstar, if the going gets rough and starts to look like things are turning against him, I think he's pretty likely to nope out of there. So I'll see y'all later.
So excellent points, guys. And I was wondering, what else are you expecting or hoping for? And it seems both of you might have a little soft spot for Darkstar. So if stroke when we see him in the Winds of Winter through Aereo's POV, and I'm talking about everything from situation, conflict and setting and character dynamics, the whole nine yards. What do you think, Minaro?
Get a little bit more of a backstory with him. And I'm hoping that it gives us a little bit more insight as to why he is considered to be so cruel and so dangerous. And thinking back to what Lady Gwyn, Lady Gwyn said earlier with respect that he might have some knowledge that actually makes him dangerous, that kind of parallels Bran having some knowledge that made him dangerous. I wonder if that also plays a part. And now that she mentions that we don't know what orders that Doran actually gave to Ariohota, I wonder if that also plays a part into that quote-unquote secret knowledge that he may also kind of have that might not make him as dangerous as we, you know, or might kind of play into that danger. But I can't wait to see what happens when he actually crosses paths with the what I'm gonna call the Darkstar Manhunt operations team. I can't wait to see what happens when he crosses paths with them, to see, you know, to see actually how that's gonna play out. And being that Lady Gwyn made that comment that we don't know what the orders actually were, it may not turn out the way that we think. Because Obara and Baylan Swan are under the impression that they're supposed to capture him. But what if it's not supposed to be actually a capture mission? What if it's something else?
And I think that I want to see some backstory, his motives, and his general nature when on home turf. I feel like he's sort of wearing some kind of mask, and I'd love to see some vulnerability that makes bad boy characters all that bit more interesting. But what could his vulnerabilities be? We're just so far from knowing that right now. But I think you can bet your butts that George has a far more complex Darkstar in his head than the one that we're all accustomed to. One great way to find a bad boy's weak spot is via a backstory, as Minaro mentioned. And the thought of where this guy has come from and what happened to him makes to make him willing and able to maim or, you know, try and kill a young girl from horseback really does intrigue me. So I think there's a lot of character work to be done, and it's all pretty fresh, to be honest, and promises to be extremely interesting given the aforementioned conflict with the bold Obara and what that could possibly bring this character to life. And another interesting aspect of his upcoming story, I think, is the setting. We learn Obara is headed to none other than High Hermitage along the Torrentine River. We know very little about all of this, and in one scenario, we get to see this place, guys, and I'm sure the Darkstar digs are splendid. There is the chance, of course.
He sounds like a rock star.
Just imagine.
It's going to be like MTV Cribs, but with Darkstar. There's always the chance, of course, that the story could be told sort of on the road, and Darkstar arrives there on the road, and High Hermitage remains off page. But of course, I prefer the former speculation. I hope we'll find out all about this place and indeed the main seat of the Danes at Starfall in The Winds of Winter. What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
I think I want to know all the Darkstar story, everything about him. I want the expose biography, please. How is he related to the main branch? What is High Hermitage like? Could he have seen Ned's party traveling past his home in 283? What exactly is his relationship with Arianne? How did he ever get involved in her plot? How did she communicate with him? Why do the Martells seem to respect his power or his ability to cause trouble so much? And getting away from his backstory, will his arc redeem his character in The Winds of Winter? And I'm not talking about his actual personality character, as in his morality or anything like that, but his status as a character in the novel. Give him some more dimension, George, and validate those of us who have been holding out hope for all these years that he is going to be a truly interesting character in The Winds of Winter. And yes, obviously, a little bit of Darkstar fandom going on here, but we will have more on where that might be going shortly.
I can't help but think every time I hear the name Darkstar, there's like some metal music like playing around in the background.
He needs to have his own like theme
and there's
song.
Like smoke. Yeah. There's like all of this smoke coming out as he walks, as he comes galloping on his horse. It's
like he's always kind of wherever he is. There's a strategically positioned like fan to blow,
like blowing in the wind.
I should have never started calling him a bad boy in this stream. I've set you two off. So we've heard today everyone's thoughts about Darkstar. So tell me, why do you think George would create a character like Geraldine Monaro?
Well, Geraldine is the opposite of all the men we know that come from the Dane line. Most of the men we know from House Dane are honorable and brave men. Their deeds allow them to have the honor of being called Sword of the Morning and to bestow upon them the ancestral sword Dawn as part of that title. But I think George felt he needed to insert a black sheep or a black star or a dark star in the line. Otherwise, the family would be too picture perfect. So in addition, I want to add that it seems to be that way in every house, right? There's always a one particular character in every household that has like this dark mark attached to them. And the one that comes to mind is Blackfish, right? Because he takes the name Blackfish as part of his moniker in House Tully. And it's interesting that Darkstar takes the name Darkstar as his moniker instead of Sword of the Morning.
Yeah, and of course he says, I am of the night. So he's got all this kind of dark imagery about him. What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
Well, I think that's all quite true. Back in 2006 at Worldcon, Ran Elio Garcia reported that, quote, George doesn't seem to have known that Darkstar isn't very popular in the fandom. He thought that a bad boy character would go over quite well, since people seem to love the Hound and even Theon Greyjoy so very much. So, yeah, I think he wanted to insert some sort of drama into Dorne to give us this, you know, color, local color, if you will. And I personally find that comparison to Sandor and Theon coming right from George's head, just in an off-the-cuff comment, is very interesting. Those characters might both be bad boys on the outside, but they have very rich backstories and lots of internal conflict that goes along with that. So put that in the more to come category.
Yeah, I guess on the downside, we're not going to see him fleshed out quite as much as those two characters, especially Theon with his POV. But anyway, the Winds of Winter's many pages, so there's enough for some character development of Darkstar. I think it's worth noting, with the proposed 5-year gap, that Edric could have been Sword of the Morning and the Man of the House, so to speak, and his age would have been appropriate for those roles, I think. However, as it's been noted in the fandom, George did a U-turn on the concept of the five-year gap between A Storm of Swords and Feast, and this really did cause a lot of problems with the continuity and the timeline and really the ages of characters, especially those of the younger characters who would have sort of skipped right into adulthood had this gap been implemented. So perhaps there is a decent case to be made that this Edric void needed to be filled and shored up somehow. And so George might have sort of sketched in Darkstar along those lines. So I think this is the last Darkstar question I'm going to ask. I was going to say, does Darkstar have an important role to play in the story going forward? Or is he simply an emo parody of his more famous cousin, like a lot of fans seem to assume? If he really is important to the story, I'd like to know why. Minaro?
I think he has a role to play, but it may not be a huge role. His role may just be to drive the Dorne plot forward in some way. If he decides to slip away from High Hermitage, and he may end up hooking up with the Fagon crew, and that may give him the advantage that he wants with respect to being made Lord of Starfall. He may be able to offer his sword in return for being made Lord of Starfall, and then also, I guess, by default, being named Sword of the Morning, and then womp-de-womp, you know, Dawn is now his sword. He is an enigmatic character for a reason, and so I don't think George would have inserted him in the Dorne story arc if he didn't have a part to play. He comes from a very honorable house, even though he's a branch of that house, and the Danes have played a pivotal role in the Targaryen dynasty, so much so that Aegon the Fifth has some direct lineage to somebody from the House of Dane. So he may yet be one Dane that plays a pivotal role in the Targaryen dynasty or Blackfyre dynasty, if we go along with the Blackfyre conspiracy that you both talked about a few years back. So Darkstar would fit right in with the Blackfyre plot. Again, all of these darker characters, or the opposite of the characters that we see as the good ones, and then we have like the bad ones. And so he would probably fit in with the Blackfyre plot if that's how George would steer his character, as a way of, if he were to not face off with Obara and Arya Hota and Ser Bailon Swan, and he were to escape in some way, maybe he might end up hooking up with Aegon and John Connington.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty popular viewpoint of where he might be going. I mean, I have to say that I definitely think he has a role to play. And as I was saying, my answer to the last question, the fact that George mentally compares Darkstar to characters like Theon and Sandor should really, really, really make us take note. Remember that neither of those characters was particularly sympathetic when we first met them. Sandor was really scary from the Stark kid's point of view. And then he killed Micah, a young, innocent boy. Theon was, in Jon Snow's words, an ass. And then far worse, he was accused of being a child killer, of killing his own foster brothers. So somehow, over time, the author has managed to make each of them into a compelling character whom fans find a lot of nuance in, and a lot of fans cite these two characters as among their favorite characters. So like Minaro said, why create this character at such a late stage of the narrative without a purpose? There are lots of theories out there in the fandom about what he might do or why he might do it. We get the usual hidden identity stuff. I'm not kidding. He's the real Viserys, was something I read on Reddit a couple days ago. Not really buying that one, but they're out there. He might join up with Aegon, like I just said, or he might be instrumental in whatever happens with Dawn. whether it's with, you know, to do with him directly or something else. But I want to suggest that whatever he does do, his character could also be an opportunity for George to continue his conversation on knights and knighthood. What if Arthur Dayne, shining white knight, the hero of Jamie's youth, wasn't all he was cracked up to be? He served Aerys, after all, and we do have to hold anyone who did that to account at some point. And in fact, when questioned about that, George gave his standard, keep reading. So there's more information to come about that. What if Darkstar turns out to be some sort of anti-hero? I mean, what I'm saying is that this character has barely been introduced to us at this point in the story. There's still two books and a lot more story to come for George to weave his magic. So I think we should all take his advice and keep reading, which usually means, you know, don't form your opinion yet, because I got a lot more information to give you in the future.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, so I think we're around the halfway point, and let's be lighthearted for a moment. Lady Gwyn, over to you, because we did a Twitter poll about Darkstar, didn't we?
Yes, we did. It's been a while since we did a Twitter poll before a live stream, but we thought this is a great opportunity to get back to doing that. So our Twitter poll was, tell us what you think of Darkstar. And we had four options. We had, he's a pathetic failure of a character. And that, you know, in my point of view, that meant from a writing standpoint. Actually, I think we phrased it, he's a pathetic emo. In the poll. Then we also had the option of evil would-be child killer. Could be interesting. More to come. Maybe just getting interesting. And then finally, option four was he's my boy. So here's how it all panned out. We had 471 people vote in the poll. 25% of them, or around 118, went with pathetic emo. 18%, or around 85, just can't get beyond the attack on Marcella and went with evil would-be child killer. 46%, 216 people voting. Could be interesting. More to come. So maybe, you know, waiting to see what happens with this character. And coming in at 11%, or 52 votes, he's my boy. So I know that our friend Sanrixian out there in the chat was one of those people. We managed to bump it from 10 to 11% right in the last hour. So that's something. Interesting thing about the poll is that those numbers pretty much stayed static from the first 10 minutes all the way to the end. So I think that is going to indicate that, you know, everybody's got their opinions and they're, you know, they're pretty well formed. People weren't really changing their minds at that point about Darkstar. Maybe we've changed some minds. I don't know. But we could give our own answers here if you guys want
to. Yeah,
do
it.
Okay.
What's yours, Lady Gwyn?
I was in the 46%. Could be interesting. More to come. Much more of the definitely interesting, more to come. But the way we phrased it, I chose that one. Although I kind of tip into he's my boy, because I do like him. I do like the character a lot. So
Minare, what do you think? What's your vote?
he's definitely my boy. But then, you know, I don't know what that says about me, because I usually gravitate towards all of the bad boy characters because they seem to have most of the fun. And yes, I know he tried to take the head off of a little child. I know that doesn't really bode well for him, but I'm thinking that he probably felt he had a really good reason and didn't have any other options. And so maybe I'm a bad person to say that maybe I might give him a pass because he had a good reason for it. I mean, it was either that or his head would have came off. So, you know, self-preservation sometimes. But yeah, other than that, I think he's a pretty cool character. He's my boy. I'm going to hang in there with him. Maybe he'll change.
Right, exactly.
So our friend and patron, Yogi, said that why can't it be all four? So I'm going to go with that. Pathetic, evil, could be interesting. He's my boy. I'll go with that.
Slight correction. Yogi said he's definitely not my boy.
Oh.
He's in the chat and I don't want to misrepresent what he
Sorry, man.
What he said. But someone in response to him did claim that it was all of the above. So obviously we had fun with that. So there you go.
Yeah, sometimes we run Twitter polls the night before the live stream, so you can follow us on Twitter. Okay, why don't we move forward and start the second half of the broadcast and sort of zoom in on a few of the characters who aren't Darkstar and House Dane, because he's not the only interesting person. What about Edric? Last seen with Beric Dondarrion's BWB, Lord Edric Dane seems to have vanished from the page in front of our eyes. What do you think he's been up to? And will we see him in Dawn in the Winds of Winter? What do you think, Minara?
I think he's back at Starfall by now. He is now the Lord of Starfall. So I think he's back there. He's probably, you know, gotten with his aunt, told her all about Lord Beric and his death. And also, you know, I believe that he's probably being groomed now that he is the lord of the house, to be groomed to be able to take up his responsibilities. We may see him in the Winds of Winter. And if we do, I think we're going to see him through Arya Hotah's point of view, because again, the fact that they're going after, he's part of the team that's going after Darkstar. I'm sure they're going to make a stop over by Starfall on the way to get to High Hermitage. And I'm hoping through, if they do make a stop and we do see him, that we'll also see Ilaria, because I think those two have a lot of information that they can tell us that we don't know, because it's their house. They both kind of grew up in Starfall, so they can give us a lot of backstory that we're missing. And maybe Lady Gwyn can get all of that information that she's looking for, the softer side of Darkstar that she's hoping to find out, that something happened to him in his childhood which made him the way that he is. So unless we hear about him from somebody else's point of view that can give us an update as to what is happening in Starfall, I'm thinking that we'll see him on the pages of Arya Hotah's point of view.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's pretty likely that Edric Dane and maybe Aengai, because he's not with the BWB anymore either, apparently. I think they probably left the Riverlands together after Beric's final death. And the Winds of Winter is going to find them maybe at least temporarily at Starfall. I do wonder, though, if he'll still hold some loyalty for his brethren in the Riverlands, if this pair might come across or might have already come across Greenbeard and the Mad Huntsman, other members of the BWB who were last known to be foraging south of the Mander. Could we see a mini BWB reunion in Dorne through Arya Hotah's eyes? That would be weird if he rolled up to Starfall and there's Edric hanging out with a bunch of people from the Brotherhood Without Banners. I don't know. We could hope. At 13, Edric is still some years away from possibly being a knight. Like Yokeboy was saying, he's, with the 5-year gap, he would have been the perfect age to be a young warrior and possibly assume the role of Sword of the Morning. But barring that, I expect he's going to play some role with whatever ends up happening with Don, since George can hardly keep Chekhov's legendary sword out of the narrative forever.
Well, I think you guys have more or less covered it. What could I add? I'm particularly interested to see if we ever get any confirmation that Edric is called Ned as an homage to the Ned Stark, or if that remains fan speculation forever, because I think people have thought that for a long time. Personally, I do think it's meant to be part of the connection George is clearly trying to make between Stark and Dane, which is going to come up again shortly, and there will be crackpots today later on, so don't go anywhere. So why don't we talk about Illyria? Because we fully expect her to be at Starfall, the first member of House Dane we might see on page in The Winds of Winter is Edric's aunt Illyria, once Lord Beric's betrothed. What role will she play in The Winds of Winter? And furthermore, is there more to this character than meets the eye? Is there something secret, or is there something going on? What do you think, Monaro?
I think Illyria's role may serve an unexpected role. She will probably serve as a guardian to Edric Dane, as his aunt, as he is now the Lord of Starfall. So she may, we don't hear anything about his parents. So we, well, other than she's his aunt and her older brother was his father, but I didn't hear anything about his mother. So she may end up fulfilling that role for Edric. She's also probably going to be present when, again, the Dark Star Manhunt team comes around. And so I'm sure they'll probably question her and ask her questions. And through asking her questions, we may get some of the backstory that we're looking for. And plus, she also probably holds a lot of the backstory for the Dane family. So we may see some exchange with respect to that between, you know, I know they're not supposed to be any more new point of views, but maybe we may get that once again, we see those other three characters coming through Starfall. This is going to be kind of a stretch, but I'm also thinking that she may also play a role during the Fagon plotline, since there's some proximity between her family and the Targaryens. She may also be a contender as a betrothal to Fagon, along with Arianne. So she may know the truth also about Ashara Dane's fate, meaning I know there's some speculation out there as to whether or not Ashara Dane is actually dead or not. So she may be able to give us the answers that we really are looking for to kind of put that to rest so that we know what Ashara Dane's actual fate is. So I think she's a character that has like a well of information about the Dane family and through which we can learn a lot. That may be a reason why George has not really given us much in her point of view. Through any conversations with the Darkstar Manhunt operations team, as I've called them, we may get some backstory and some new information.
I agree. Bring on all of that backstory, please. Definitely think she's going to be the first member of House Dane that we see on page in The Winds of Winter. So that's where I expect her to maybe bring a giant information dump. But let's talk about what's going on with this character, Illyria Dane. She's supposedly the younger sister of Arthur and Ashara, born just before those two elder siblings died, who they apparently died within a very short time of one another. She's raised at Starfall, eventually betrothed to Beric Dondarrion, a young lord from a marcher house in the Stormlands. And what I find intriguing about Illyria is her age. It's never mentioned specifically, but based on textual cues, it's possible that she's just about 18 years old early in The Winds of Winter, maybe a year or so older than Jon Snow. In other words, she just might have been conceived around the time of the tourney at Harrenhal. I've always felt, that the inclusion of Illyria, an improbable, slightly really, because you have three very grown-up children in this generation. So I feel like she's an improbable younger sibling of that generation that includes Arthur, Ashara, and Edric's father. I find that very curious. Not impossible. I mean, it happens, but curious. I wonder about Ashara's so-called stillborn daughter, who was apparently born around the same time that Illyria might have been born. And I wonder whether there's a connection. In real life, I know of several families where a young unmarried girl got pregnant and had her child in secret, and then it was passed off by an adult family member as their own, by her mother as a younger sibling, for instance, or in one case that I know actually quite well, by an aunt as a cousin. So I wonder, could Ashara have done something similar, passing off her daughter as her sister and putting around the story to a small circle at court who may have seen her visibly pregnant, that her child had actually been stillborn? But my mom had a baby. Meet my sister, right? So we'll be diving more into Ashara next, but suffice it to say that while it seems like something happened to her at the tourney of Harrenhal, and whether that was a consensual affair with someone like Brandon Stark or something much darker, like an assault or some other sort of dishonor, to echo Barristan Selmy's thoughts, we don't really know yet. But perhaps someday we will. And if we do, I predict it will involve Illyria. Also feel like it's important to make note here before we go into more depth about Ashara that Barristan never specifically says she was dishonored by a Stark. He says that she was possibly mad with grief for the child she had lost and perhaps for the man who had dishonored her at Harrenhal as well. And he wonders if he had confessed his feelings to her, whether she might have looked to me instead of Stark. So those two sentences are removed from one another. So I think it really could go either way. There could be a connection. There could that Stark could be the dishonorer, or he could not be. So it would just be someone that she looked to for help after that dishonoring happened. But it's also possible, and even likely, knowing Barristan, that dishonor is in the eye of the beholder. You got Barristan, who's a relatively conservative, I would guess, and based on what we know of him, he's from the Stormlands, you know, may have seen whatever went on as dishonor when something could be completely normal in Dorne. In Dorne, you get the princess of Dorne openly talking about her sex life with her father, the unmarried princess of Dorne, his heir. And her father seems embarrassed, not because she had sex, but because he's her father, right? So, you know, I think Barristan is very likely to see something as dishonorable that maybe in Dornish culture would just be seen as completely normal. We can't really know. Again, keep reading. More to come before we can really make that call.
Okay, great points. And I'm particularly excited by the cracking of pots. It's House Dane, everyone. It wouldn't be House Dane if we didn't not just crack some pots, if we broke all the pots. So we're going to turn the crackpot up to 11 from this point on. We're going to begin with Ashara Dane. Ashara is a character from the past who invites all sorts of speculation, once rumoured to be the mother of Ned Stark's bastard son. There is a confusing and often contradictory array of stories told about her. She and Ned were in love. She was dishonoured at Harrenhal. She bore a stillborn daughter. She killed herself out of grief after the loss of her brother. She was John's mother. Her death was a result of Ned taking her child away. The details and speculation goes on. So what do we really think is going on here with this mysterious character, Ashara Dane? Manaro?
Yeah, I agree. There are a lot of speculations with respect to Ashara Dane, but I tend to lean toward the more simpler explanation. I do believe that there may have been some interaction between her and Ned, and her, or her and the Stark brothers at Harrenhal. It was a pretty, you know, a pretty big tourney. So it's not hard to believe that they had some interaction, but I don't think their interaction was more than maybe a kiss or a dance. If she had been dishonored, as we hear at Harrenhal, I don't believe it was any of the Stark brothers. I tend to think that she may have had a secret relationship, and that her pregnancy was a result of that, and that that liaison may have happened at the tourney. I do often wonder if she killed herself because of grief over someone else that was present at the Tower of Joy and not her brother. And my thought went to maybe Oswell went. It is possible they may have had a secret relationship, and that when Ned came back and gave her the news about what happened at the Tower of Joy and to return Dawn, she may have been stricken with grief, not only because she lost her baby, but also the father of said baby. I know it's a stretch, but it has crossed my mind.
Yeah, that's a good point. And of course, this is just what Barristan thinks, that it wasn't just the baby, but also a man, or the loss of a man, that drove her mad with grief. But in my opinion, if the dishonor at Harrenhal was the cause of the so-called stillborn child, then we have a slight timeline issue, because the tourney of Harrenhal occurred well over a year and a half at best guess, maybe significantly more, before Ned arrived at Starfall with Dawn from the Tower of Joy. This much is evident in the fact that Aegon, born some months after the tourney — we know Ilya was pregnant at the tourney, but she wouldn't have been able to travel if she was heavily pregnant. So, you know, his birth had to take place several months at least afterwards. And he is said by George R. R. Martin to be a year old, give or take a turn or two at the sack. Turn by a turn, he means a month. So, you know, we're up to, you know, definitely more than a year, possibly as much as, you know, maybe 14, 16 months at the sack since the tourney. So add a couple of months after that for Ned to go to Storm's End, lift the siege, travel to the Tower of Joy, confront the King's Guard, and finally make his way to Starfall, where he found Lady Ashara, and you might begin to see the issue. In Barristan's worldview, Ashara had a stillborn child, and then 9 months, give or take a few months, so make it 6 to 12 months later, she killed herself with grief over it. And if the man who caused her grief was maybe Brandon Stark, as many suggest, he'd also been dead for over a year, and it's unlikely that Ned was the one breaking that news to her. She would have heard that already. So I'm not saying that there's a limitation on grief. There certainly is not. I'm saying that something about this story doesn't feel right. And it's this inconsistency, which I think brings all of those Ashara is still alive theories to bear. Something I think we'll get back to in just a moment. But one more thing I want to add is that Barristan, who is both our best and worst source on Ashara, because while he clearly paid very close attention to her, all of his opinions are sort of rose-tinted because he adores her. So you have to, you know, we take his viewpoint, but we have to take it with a grain of salt. But Barristan clearly holds Ned in very high esteem. He never thinks badly of Ned. So I think it's unlikely that if Ned was the one who, in Barristan's worldview, dishonored his love, Ashara, that he would be thinking so highly of him. On the other hand, in another context, he also thinks about how women always choose fire over mud. And of the two Stark brothers, Brandon is clearly fire, whereas shy, solemn Ned is mud, much more akin to, you know, the dutiful Quentin, who Barristan is thinking about specifically in that context. But therefore, I think in Barristan's worldview, Ned would be unlikely to attract the attention of someone like Ashara, whereas someone like Brandon Stark, unpredictable, definitely a fireman who we could compare to Dario, which is who Barristan was thinking of when he had that thought. I think it's more likely to have been Brandon, just going off of his perception of things.
Good answers, guys. I think that what all these stories about a Sharad Dane do show us on a sort of meta level is how the rumor mill works within the story. And I think this is something that George loves to play with and also serves to point something out to the reader. There's an important story here, guys. He's very short on details, but keep reading, as we've said, George loves to say. So more details to come on this one. And to continue with the conversation about a Sharad Dane, at the end of the day, what is Ashara's role in the story? Are we supposed to think she's still alive? I think, as I said, we're really going to enter crackpot territory. So, guys, why don't you share your favourite unlikely theory about Ashara, and a shout out to patron Rohan Blackwood for encouraging us here. Monaro.
Okay, so I'm really bad at crackpots, but here we go. So just as a caveat, I tend to think that she's dead. I think she's dead, not alive, is not breathing, is not undead, is not walking among us, is not, you know, I think she has gone to meet her maker by throwing herself over a tower and landing against some rocks. I don't know why anybody would want to kill themselves that way. That looks very painful, but there you have it. The crackpot that I probably would be more likely to believe is the Septa Lamor crackpot, that she is actually secretly Septa Lamor and that she is part of this whole Blackfyre plot about putting Aegon son back on the throne. That would be the only crackpot that I think that I would be more likely to be on board with if I were into, you know, really good at crackpotting, but I don't crackpots. I cook in them because I'm a foodie, and which has nothing to do with this stream, but I thought I'd mention it. But I listen to them, and usually when I listen to a lot of these crackpots, I'm like, I don't understand how that makes sense. But then, you know, I'm a linear person sometimes, and I'm kind of weird that way. So yeah, I think the Septa Lamor crackpot would be the one that I would more likely lean towards going with. And the reason behind that, I would think maybe she feels that she's aligning herself to do some good. Maybe things didn't work out for her, but maybe she can do something for the Targaryens. I don't know. I have no idea, but there you have it.
Well, I definitely respect the idea that she simply died, as stated, because sometimes, you know, we have to think a death is just a death. But in that case, I think we would need a whole lot more information to explain the inconsistencies I mentioned earlier. And just in that, so far, all of our information comes from Barristan, or most of our information comes from Barristan, and we would just need to hear from other people, like why this happened. Maybe we just will never know why it happened. If that's the case, sometimes we don't in these cases, right? So, but the whole keep reading aura that surrounds not only Ashara but House Dane in general might be leading to this. At the same time, that aura of mystery could be leading to a revelation along the lines of what many fans expect, that in the absence of eyewitnesses to Ashara's death or a body as physical proof that she's dead, that she's still very much alive. Now, if that's the case, could she perhaps be hiding out as Howland Reed's wife at Greywater Watch? I know there's some people in the chat who love this idea. That's an understatement. It was originally suggested by a poster called Maiden and Warrior back on Westeros.org in 2013. Maybe they fell in love at Harrenhal, had an affair, and then she later you know, needed to protect her knowledge about the baby that Ned carried with him out of the mountains all those years ago. So I think that this is a great theory thematically. I kind of have issues with the timeline. I think Mira Reed is either slightly too young or slightly too old to have been conceived around either of the known intersections of Highland and Ashara, which were at Harrenhal and at Starfall or later. But, you know, it's not insurmountable. So, in fact, there's just enough flex. Thanks, George. This is the way he always leaves it, that it's impossible to rule it out. So then you get the Septa Lemoore theory. This is very well trodden, and the textual and timeline evidence all seem to fit. The principal objection seems to be that Tyrion never notices Lemoore's eye color. But look, this is George R.R. Martin, who gets these little details wrong all the time. And since Barristan, this is interesting, I thought, thinks about how similar Dany's eyes are to Ashara's, I say wait and see what happens when Tyrion comes face to face with Dany. If he starts to think that Dany's eyes remind him of someone, could it be Lemoore? Then bingo, you have this kind of transitive property of Dany reminds me of Lemoore. Dany reminds Barristan of Ashara, and therefore, you know, maybe that's a bigger hint. No, I don't think, for the record, that Ashara is Dany's mother, so, which is also a theory that's out there. But I do not subscribe to that one. However, there's one thing that troubles me about the Lemoore theory, and that's the level of groundwork that George put into Ashara early on, which seems to be at odds with the assumption that the Fagon storyline wasn't something that he planned until much later. So could he have changed direction with the character? Of course he could have. He could have developed it some in his own way or used her as he saw fit. But then we have to explain why it makes sense for her to involve herself in a plot with Varys when there seems to be so much in the text thematically that's connecting her to the Starks. So it's, you know, definitely possible to explain all that in terms of her loyalty to Ilya and Rhaegar. She could be a female mirror to John Connington, but there are always these lingering doubts about that connection with House Stark, which continue to be made right into A Dance with Dragons. And one more thing, if Ashara is Lemoore, you should keep an eye on John Connington's point of view. They're together at Storm's End right now in the beginning of The Winds of Winter. Connington and Ashara definitely knew each other before the rebellion. They shared a dance at the tourney of Harrenhal. And so if that is the truth of it, then it's very likely to be revealed in his point of view. And finally, the last theory that has gained some support in the fandom, apparently, is that Ashara is Quaithe. This one basically exists because Quaithe's identity seems mysterious, and she has an obvious interest in Daenerys, and she speaks the common tongue. But the only physical feature that's ever commented on is her eyes. And they're not noted to be purple. So if this was true, then George really missed an opportunity to drop a hint or some sort of, you know, textual connection, something there. And then also this theory really falls apart at the why, because you have to get increasingly convoluted to explain why Ashara Dane would secretly leave Westeros to become a shadow binder in Ashai. So, to sum up, I think that George's keep reading mentality around this character, he told fans now over 20 years ago that all will be revealed in due time, definitely means that she will have some significance to the story going forward. But whether she's an important dead person or a still very much alive person might be up for debate. We obviously have a lot more to learn about House Dane, and we definitely expect that a lot of that is going to be coming our way early in The Winds of Winter when Aerys Hota arrives at their home base. So,
yes. So with a couple of those theories, you mentioned the eyes. I don't think I can get past it because they're described as like haunting and violet. I just think that that's her most striking feature, you know, and it's sort of a bit of a contradiction for a POV just to to miss that or not note it. I would feel a little bit cheated by that. And then back to the Ashara Dane could be like living in the neck with some lizard lions. I kind of like that one. It's very I find it very wholesome. I feel like when I read about this, someone's giving me a hug. You know, she's out there. She's the mother of Jojen and Mira, and she's with Howlin in Howl's Moving Castle somewhere in the neck. Yeah, it's quite wholesome, that one. And I think it makes a surprising amount of sense. And like, maybe it doesn't have the evidence to be like the strongest theory, but at the same time, I can't sort of find a fatal flaw or debunk it. And I feel at the very least it's interesting and wholesome. So look that one up. Okay, from one crack, let's crank the crackpot. We're on 11 crackpot. Now let's go to 12. We're going to talk about Dawn, the sword Dawn. It's the famous Dane sword. Dawn is a unique blade clearly designed to stand out to the reader. It seems to have the properties of Valyrian steel, yet we know that it's not Valyrian steel and is apparently made from the heart of a fallen star. It cuts Jaime's shoulder to the touch when he is knighted by Sir Arthur Dane. It has an unusual pale as milk glass colouring and has an unmistakable sort of X factor by its very design. Overall, this is a seldom mentioned blade that George does not want us to forget about. George has said in an interview that Dawn does indeed have an illustrious history, but has withheld further detail. So what kind of history do you think Dawn has had? And again, feel free to go wild with crackpots here. What do you think, Minari?
I believe Dawn may have been used in the First Long Night. I actually went back to listen to your podcast that you did on the Long Night. And so I think I'm kind of feeling more affirmed that I think that it was actually used during the First Long Night. It also has the same description as the others, who are described as pale and have bones of milk glass. So it makes me wonder if there's a correlation in the creation of the others and the creation of Dawn. Also, the sword and the weapon that are used by the Dawn, the sword, and the weapons that are used by the others are also considered pale and very sharp. Though the weapons that are used by the others are described as crystal-like, they tend to have a lot of the same similarities in that they are pale and that they are very sharp. So there's a level of reverence with Dawn in that you have to earn it in order to be able to wield it. It's not just something that is passed on. So I'm leaning towards, I think there is that the creation of Dawn has some correlation with the creation of the others, especially if I'm leaning towards that it was actually used during the First Long Night, because if they are similar in their makeup, it would make sense that it is an actual lethal weapon against the others.
Excellent points, Monaro, about the similarities in the sort of minutia descriptions between Dawn and the others. And I think that does raise some good points. But I'm going to talk about a theory which in some ways is very, very similar, and in other ways is the polar opposite. The notion that Dawn could be the ancient Lightbringer blade of the Long Night era is an old one, and I think it's still quite popular in the fandom. I'm very interested in this theory. It sort of fires my imagination and gets me thinking about things. Dawn as a name would be an obvious choice for a blade that had previously been called Lightbringer, and then the light came, so you call it Dawn. Perhaps when Lightbringer's flame went out at the end of the Long Night, the red blade cooled to a pale white and the sword was renamed appropriately as the darkness receded and the morning dawn shone its light down on Westeros for the first time in perhaps a generation or however long. As I said before, it's a blade George has purposefully designed to be unique, and although it's on the fringes of the story thus far, to me, that could make it even more suspicious. Like, why are you hiding over there, George? Why are you withholding all this detail from us? when George says Dawn has an illustrious history, it could be an exercise in grand understatement. One theory I enjoy is that Nissa Nissa might have been a Dane after the Long Night, and remembering it said that Nissa Nissa's soul went into the blade, Dawn could have been given to the house for safekeeping until the next Azor Ahai arises. We're told Dawn was forged from the heart of a fallen star, and ostensibly, of course, that refers to this meteorite. But if Nissa Nissa was a Dane, whose sigils is a star, it could take on a double meaning here, and the heart of a fallen star could be Nissa's literal heart. Lady Gwyn, can you add to this crackpot or add in any way?
Well, I just want to add that this theory has my heart. I love that double meaning. The fallen star being at once a meteorite and a woman of House Dane. Of course, this would require that the Dane sigil predates the sword, but you know what? This is a work of literature. It's not real life. And if George wants to make it so, it's his sandbox. So great. I just love the wordplay of this theory. So yeah. And also George freely admits that as far as the origins of House Dane go, things are a bit fuzzy. So why not?
I think if you like this theory and you like thinking about this subject matter, you could visit or revisit episode 8 way back in the day. I think it's 2014, where we did an episode called Fear is for the Long Night. I think that was the name of it. And this is when we started talking about and making this theory. And yeah, it's all grown on that episode. So go and check it out. Okay, so the Danes have a system and a position in place regarding Dawn and who gets to wield it. This position is called the Sword of the Morning. Again, it's a unique and mysterious part of the Dane family. And we know very little, in fact, about how the Sword of the Morning works and is chosen and functions, etc. So patron Christine wonders, do we think there will be a Sword of the Morning chosen in the remaining novels before our eyes? What do you think, Minara?
I tend to think that we won't see a Sword of the Morning in the remaining novels. Edric is too young, and at the time that we're reading the story, he was a squire at the time that he became Lord of Starfall. So he still would have to attain knighthood, because most of everybody who's wielded who's wielded Dawn and become Sword of the Morning were knights. Also, by default and extension, Darkstar is too much of a bad boy to be even given the title, so he's out of the running. So, but even though that doesn't mean that someone will not wield it in the upcoming battle with the others, if there is one. I think the Sword of the Morning is part of the heritage of House Dane that adds to their unique backstory and their mystery. But I believe the true star of the Sword of the Morning title is actually Dawn, because they go hand in hand. Part of you attaining that honor of being called the Sword of the Morning is that you get the honor of wielding. I believe Dawn will also play a pivotal role in the battle for the Dawn. So, I know, right? I'm cheesy. So, I think that I don't think we'll see someone named the Sword of the Morning, but I do believe we will see someone wield the sword itself. Because if anybody will be named Sword of the Morning, it'll probably be Edric, but I don't see the story, you know, unless there's like a huge long epilogue that goes into, you know, what happens in with Edric Dane to say he earns the title. I don't see us seeing that honor bestowed on anybody.
Well, the timeline is a very good point as far as dealing with, you know, what we have so far. But I am curious about the fact that so much is made of this sword. George goes so far as to credit it in large part for Sir Arthur Dane's reputation. So when people questioned why Arthur Dayne was considered to be so wonderful in comparison to someone like Barristan Selmy, who's so much older and has so many more experiences to draw upon, he actually referred to the sword Dawn. He said that his reputation comes from that sword. So my opinion is, why introduce it, create this mythology about it, about the fact that it doesn't go to the heir of Starfall, but rather is bestowed upon the distressingly vague, most worthy candidate. What does that mean? We don't know, but, unless he means to introduce a worthy candidate to wield it, I don't know why he included all that information. So the whole thing is all very kind of sword in the stone-ish, which makes me believe that if there is a candidate, it will be someone entirely unlikely, someone we never thought of. Think about the movie The Sword in the Stone. It's a Disney cartoon, but it's based on Arthurian legend, and the kid who pulls the sword out of the stone in that Disney movie is called Wart. Well, it's actually based on the Once and Future King. So Wart, really? And scrawny little kid. Totally unlikely. So I don't know. George has also said that we'll learn more about the office of Sword of the Morning eventually. So he's introduced it. He's promised that someday he's going to explain it. And he has said that Dawn is being kept at Starfall until another Sword of the Morning shall arise. So does that mean that it will happen? That it won't happen? We can't really say. I mean, I tend to think that it means that one will, but maybe that's wishful thinking. All that said, I'm not sure it would be Darkstar, since he's so far fairly unworthy. And if George is really thinking of him along the lines of Sandor and Theon, characters like that, he's going to have a long way to go to prove any kind of worthiness, which, I don't know that we have enough time and space in the narrative for all that. I don't know. However, George is also noted to be withholding a Dane family tree for the Winds of Winter. So there could be a surprise relative waiting in the wing, someone we haven't met or haven't considered. Imagine finding out that some random person that maybe that we've known all along is closely related to the Danes. And regarding that, before we leave this topic, I have to point out that we do know that both Jon and Daenerys carry Dane blood. You alluded to it earlier, I believe. They have this ancestor, Diana Dane, who was the mother of Aegon V. So they're both definitely descendants of Danes. So I think it is impossible at this point to rule either of them out as somehow being considered worthy recipients of the sword.
Okay, so we've heard speculation about Dawn's potentially very large role in Westerosi history, and the office of the Sword of the Morning. Now let's wrap up our chat regarding this strange and wonderful sword by talking about what role it could play in the upcoming books. Could Dawn help the battle against the others? If so, how would it make its way up north into appropriate hands? Minara, why don't you take us away?
I think it could play a big role in the battle against the others. If we are to believe that Dawn was forged to help with the First Long Night, then it definitely could help against the battle against the others. I know there's speculation that Jon will wield Dawn in that battle. How it would get north, maybe Edric and Ilaria Dayne could bring on Dawn north as part of some sort of a Westerosi alliance to a common foe, or they can send it via an envoy. Also, they could give Dawn towards that battle, also in honor of the fact that Ned once made the trip after Arthur Dayne died at the Tower of Joy, and he returned the sword. So maybe as some sort of reciprocity, they may return the favor by allowing House Stark, i.e. Jon, to wield it for the battle. I'm not sure how else Dawn could make it north other than House Dayne either physically taking it there themselves or sending it there via some sort of an envoy, or somebody from the north coming to Starfall to claim the take the sword and then going back.
Wow, Minara, that idea that they could sort of repay the favor to the Starks in their hour of need. I've never heard that, and you know, I thought it was great. I really enjoyed listening to that. I thought I've heard everything, but that's new to me. And I thought that it was a pretty neat take there. So overall, we don't know for sure how Jord is going to handle this Azor Ahai come again business with Lightbringer 2.0, and how much of history is a wheel and might be recycled and mimicked. And the TV show never really delved into this territory much at all, so we can't really gain any clues there. But if there is another Lightbringer moment, I think it would be folly not to consider Dawn as a potential candidate, at least, to the old Lightbringer that could be reignited somehow, say in the midway point of the final book when shit's going to go down. In A Dance with Dragons, Jon Snow has a dream about holding a red blade. So fans do wonder if this was a dragon dream of the future facilitated by Jon's secret Targaryen blood. If it were, could this be Dawn in his hands in a sort of prophecy? I was talking to a few of our patrons over at the Radio Westeros Discord, and our friend TJ was the one who pointed out to me how difficult it would be to physically get Dawn up north to the wall from a sort of writing and logistical perspective. It was him that inspired that part of the question. And I think it's a great point, and it's difficult to imagine this eventuality in terms of what needs to happen. If it wasn't done well, it might not feel like a natural story progression. This is what TJ said, and I think I agree with him. However, if George wanted it to happen, I don't think it's impossible. And so I wouldn't call it a fatal flaw as such. It just has some explaining to do. I guess it would involve Edric or maybe Darkstar perhaps becoming Sword of the Morning and identifying an Azor Ahai up the wall in his hour of need, or her even, when it was clear the Long Night had returned. Or else Samwell could bring it up there. That's another idea. And yeah, it's difficult to imagine, but my imagination is no match for George R.R. Martin's. The idea of the Dane in-story lore involving a sort of call to arms next time there's an others invasion is exciting to me. You know, oh, the Long Night's kicking off again. Remember our oath from 5,000 years ago? I think that would be pretty cool. It could be part of the Sword of the Morning position that again seems curiously unique and special when refers to the end of the night once more. So yeah, that could be part of the deal. If you're Sword of the Morning, you could be on standby, you know. If the others come, part of your role is to hand this blade to the new Azor Ahai, which will be evident. I know this is rich into crackpot, but yeah, I love this stuff. What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
Well, you know, I think it's clearly a magical sword or a sword of destiny. And, you know, it's not Valyrian steel, but we don't know what its powers may be yet. So, you know, Jon thinks about how they'll need all the Valyrian steel in Westeros to defeat the others. And Dawn could end up being just another tool in that ideal tool belt. And as for how it would get to the wall, I guess if George wants it to get there, he'll find a way. Edric or Darkstar head north, or I don't know, maybe even Illyria Dane or, you know, something. Some member of the family could deliver it up there. And we also have the potentially yet to be revealed Dane relative that I mentioned earlier. Once he, you know, once George reveals that Dane family tree, which he's intentionally withheld until the Winds of Winter, and we don't really know why that is yet. So, you know, if someone is revealed to be a Dane or related closely to the Danes, you know, that could come into play. And there is a lot of story left, you know, two books, guys. If we consider basically Feast and Dance as more or less one story, you know, along the timeline, there's not a huge, you know, they're pretty much parallel on the timeline. Dance goes a little beyond Feast, of course. But so if we cast ourselves back two full books and look at what ground was covered from the end of A Clash of Kings to the end of A Dance with Dragons. There's a lot of narrative ground covered there, and that's what George has left to cover, theoretically, in the next The Winds of Winter and A Dream of Spring. So, you know, I don't think anything is off the table in terms of what he could show to us in that time.
Excellent. And on to the final question. We're talking about House Dane today. I want it to be a question, all-encompassing House Dane questions. Let's finish up with a discussion about the house itself. What a house, guys! From those strange purple eyes to the Sword of the Morning to the mystical Blade Dawn, I think we can all agree that House Dane screams mystery. So how do we view and explain the Danes in this story? Why do they have those purple eyes associated with Valyrians when they're an ancient house from Westeros? People speculate that they are proto-Valyrians, but what does that even mean? George has written them to be full of mystique and placed them physically away from ancient northern houses. Is there meaning in any of this, or is this just part of George's world building to build a richer environment? George's effort to make a more wondrous world. What do you think, Manaro?
When you said proto-Valyrians, I started thinking about David from Covenant. But the Danes are definitely a mystery. They are not of Valyrian descent, but they share similar characteristics, such as the purple eyes and the pale blonde hair. It's possible that the first men that they descend from, like, I don't really know much, or I haven't read much about what the first men were like before they came over into Westeros. So we don't know who else in the population that they may have intermarried with or mated with before they came to Westeros. So there may be some explanation as to why that may be, why they have some of those same similarities, but may not necessarily be Valyrian descent. Or they may also share some other's blood, like the Stark. Again, I go back to when the Dawn was created. It was created around the same time, you know, around the time of the Long Night, and the similarities between Dawn and the others. Maybe they may also share some other mystical type of lineage, like the Starks do. So that could account for it. I think everything George does has meaning, either big or small. Every character plays a part in moving the story forward. House Dane, though shrouded in mystery, has a significant role to play, I believe. Their mystery seems to be slowly unfolding. And knowing George, who is like the master of misdirection, I believe that the mystery of House Dane will not be what we expected, but it will totally be worth it once it's revealed.
Yes. Well, I agree. Very, all very, very well said. I think that regarding those purple eyes, George has compared Ashara Dane to Elizabeth Taylor, who in real life had violet eyes, but was obviously not Valyrian. He's just George being cheeky there, but I think his point might be, or the point might be, that George likes to weave unusual features not commonly found in real life into a story. So he's either intentionally trying to cloak something, or he's just saying, yeah, I just like purple eyes. You know, I have a thing for Liz Taylor. I don't really get hung up on it, on the physical similarities too much for that reason, because that could be the case. And Ashara Dane, who has very dark hair with those violet eyes, is obviously more of a Liz Taylor type than a Valyrian type. So I don't know. But in saying that, he could also obviously be trying to divert from what his true intention is. I do want to say that the pale silvery hair of Edric and Gerald, you know, could come from elsewhere. And it's worth saying that Arthur Dane's coloring is never noted. He's often depicted as having silver hair, but it's never said that he does. So we don't really know if that sort of ash blonde hair that Edric has and what the coloring that Gerald Dane chose could be a fluke or come from elsewhere or be unrelated to purple eyes, because neither of them are noted as having purple eyes. We don't know. More information, please. So all of that said, right, every single comment George has ever made about House Dane, Arthur, Ashara, the Sword of the Morning, Dawn, and even Darkstar is couched in that keep reading language. More to come. You know, he's made a few small tantalizing reveals over time, but overall his message continues to be that there's more to come, and he's holding it back for the right moment, including that very specific information that he's holding back a family tree for the Winds of Winter. So I think that all together, that this pattern indicates that whatever is coming, it will be important.
Yes, mystery. He's definitely withholding. I just sense it. I think there is definitely some major backstory to the Danes. The fact that they are kept apart from the North, but have this ancient line and unexplainable purple eyes, must have some meaning, I think, in George's world. As Monaro said, you know, everything's done for a reason. I would love it if this all coalesced into a backstory about what they were up to during the Age of Heroes and even before that. People speculate their eyes could be Dragon Rider related. And although this is, again, into crackpot territory, really, who knows? Are you going to rule it out? It's difficult to say, isn't it? It's just, we just don't know the details. Magical bloodlines, dragons, the others, Lightbringer, Nissa Nissa, all of these things have been mentioned today, but isn't it strange that we're talking about a relatively small noble house from all the way down in Dorne? I feel today we'll leave you having provoked more questions than answers, and with House Dane, would you have it any other way? Okay, guys, thanks very much to all of you for tuning in, and of course, thanks to you, Monaro, for joining us. You have a YouTube channel called Monaro Geek TV, and it's a pop culture type of YouTube channel. Why don't you tell us about what's going on and what you've got lined up for the future and what you tend to focus on?
Thank you again, Yokeboy and Lady Gwyn, for having me on. I truly appreciate it. My channel, as you said, is kind of pop culture. I kind of turn on the camera and talk about whatever I want whatever the topic is of the day. I'm more of a organic type of channel. I don't ever, you know, I'm never really prepared. I don't have anything that I prepare to come on. I just, you know, find something of interest to me and I get on and I invite my usual cohorts to come and join me to talk about whatever. Upcoming though, I do have this anime show that I watch that I will be talking about in the next a couple of weeks. That is what's happening. I've also started incorporating being a more proactive citizen and talking about some of the issues that that we are currently facing in our world today, specifically more so in our country here in the US today. So that has been something new that I've started. Quickly, just give a quick shout out to my cohorts, the Mad Queens, Alicia Kingston, T-Baby, Timo, and Lady Diligence. And I also want to give a quick shout out to John Greenhand, without which I would never be on YouTube anyway. So I want to give a great thanks to them. And also to Sam R09, who helped me pave the way to my infamous Ginger Ale chats. So so that's what you can expect from me. If you're interested in pop culture, meaning anything with respect to what's happening on Hulu, Netflix, Disney, please feel free to subscribe to my channel. I'm not a person that uploads on a regular or on a scheduled basis, but I do upload every so often, and I usually do streams. My videos are not necessarily prepared. So if you're interested in that, please feel free to subscribe. And thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. This has been a really, truly great stream. I know that the people in the chat have really enjoyed it, and we definitely have appreciated your insight and you being here, and encourage people to definitely subscribe to your channel. Folks, if you're listening, like and subscribe right here at Radio Westeros. You also have the opportunity to support us on our Patreon. I want to tell you a little bit about what's coming up next for Radio Westeros. We soon have episode 6 of our Winds of Winter Primer. Patreon rollout, or patron rollout, starts in about a week. Be public by the end of this month, which is coming right up, which means that our next live stream, which should be in about 3 weeks' time, we have been going to bump it from the 2 weeks just because of the release schedule of the next episode, will be all about things relating to the Stormlands. We should be continuing kind of with a Dornish connection by talking about Arianne. We also have John Connington and Aegon and the Blackfyre Conspiracy coming up. So that is, those are the live streams that are going to take us right on through March and probably early April. So right on into spring as we're sitting here in the depths of winter. So stick around for that. More to come. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. And also to all you people in the future, hello. And thank you if you're listening on the pre-recorded YouTube version or the podcast version, which should be out in a few days. So we appreciate you all.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in on this afternoon. Or like Lady Gwyn said, in the future, can't wait to get this next primer release, the Stormlands. That's going to be really exciting. Thanks to each and every one of our patrons and our chat mods who facilitate these live streams and make it all possible. And guys, if you want to be a patron, then go to patreon.com. You can sign up and you get a lot of different kinds of benefits, such as you can have shout outs on certain tiers. And if you're a patron, you also get an invite to our Discord where you can hang out with us, play games, and talk about pets, food, relax things, and of course, A Song of Ice and Fire. So anyway, you can check us out on patreon.com. Hope you've enjoyed today's live stream, and thank you very much.
And bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.